So good morning. I don't know if I should have chosen this topic. In a sense, I'm an outsider. In a sense, I'm an insider. I'm an outsider because I come from Eretz Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael has its own set of problems and its own issues, some which overlap with American issues, some of which are different. Tzinut Datit, or religious Zionism, has a certain affinity and a certain overlap with modern Orthodoxy. Yet, not necessarily. You can be religious Zion, you can be Chardan, which is Charedi Le'umi, meaning you are non-modern but Zionist. You can be also, of course, non-Orthodox and non-Zionist as well. And in one regard, I'm somewhat of an outsider, at least to the American scene. On the other hand, I'm not totally an outsider. I grew up a few blocks from here, and as a child, I ran around these hallways many pleasurable hours. I subscribe also, I hope, to the modern Orthodox approach to life. And more importantly, coming from the outside, you often see and feel things that maybe are easy to see when you come once a year and from the outside, and they're not engaged day to day from the inside. One of, and I'll begin with that observation of the outsider's perspective, if we're trying to go into more of an insider's take on things as well. Coming outside, one is, I think especially from coming from religious Zionism, there's a sense of, put it a bit bluntly, maybe to overstate the case, of an imbalanced movement. Of a sense of a regression, of retreat, to compare it to what goes on in religious Zionism. Over there are many issues going on in Israel. There's many, many problems, many issues, but there's a sense of vibrancy. There's a sense that lots of things are going on in religious Zionism I think I wholly disagree with. Others I totally agree with. There's intense debate. Many of the good deal that's going on is often strikes me as being outlandish, strange, particularly Hasidish. But there's a sense of expansion of people committed, passionate. There's very little attrition from Tzinut Datit into the Haredi world. There's attrition, unfortunately, often to the secular world. But there's very little. When I was a child, it was much greater. People would cross the boundaries both ways. It's quite rare now. Each community has retreated into its own enclave. Each community is doing its own thing. It's rare that a kid from a religious Zionist high school end up going to Haredi Yeshiva. This has many disadvantages, but it's indicative of the fact that the movement itself, if to be from, this is the option, this is self-confidence, this is commitment. Coming here, one often feels there's much attrition to the rightward movement. There's a sense of apologetics almost, of schools and communities being shifting rightwards, less committed, but less apologetic almost of various things. Of course, I'm generalizing now and generalizing for a purpose. But this thing, you ever come to a modern Orthodox school, or whatever, and you feel you have to almost justify the fact that you're modern Orthodox. I was told. I'm here on a recruiting trip now. I was told, don't always wave the modern Orthodox credentials. It's not necessarily a good recruiting tool. You'll often turn away either teachers or prospective students. Modern Orthodoxy is not what they're interested about or what they want to hear. I'd like to somehow try to address this issue to explain, in a sense, what I think is going on, and then, if we're to also to switch gears and to make more of a claim or more of a challenge. But differently, I'm going to begin a little bit with some history and sociology, even though it's not my profession, and then move on to a Rav's domain, meaning calling people, trying to mobilize them spiritually. I'll begin with an anecdote, which may be sometimes to get across the problematic point of modern orthodoxy. And I think I'm not the first to observe this. In other words, the fact that there's a sense of retreat is not. I didn't wake up and discover America yesterday, and I think obviously many people have are aware of this and are dealing with these issues. When I was a child, there was in Yerushalayim, there was a well-known magid, a darshan. He was Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's brother-in-law, Rav Shlomo Shvadron. One of his favorite choice quotes was the following. It says, Rivka v'yitotetzu abani v'kirva v'tomer lama ze anochi v'teli lidrosh eloki. So Rashi says over there that she, what was going on? She would pass by Beis Avodah Zarah, he would try to leave. She would pass by Beis Medrash, he would also try to leave. So then we didn't know what was going on. So she went to Telech Hidosh Elokim. So, the way he, dashed it somewhat whimsically and somewhat seriously, and, there's no smoke without fire at the end of the day, was the problem. You see, what bothered her was not the fact that he wanted to go make some of the Zara per se. The problem was, she said to herself, who could possibly want to go to both places? In other words, the answer was these twins. Meaning, before this, she knew there were twins, she thought it was one child. So which one child can want to go both to Beit Avodah Zarah? And she passed by a movie theater, she wants to go to a movie theater. She wants to go to Beis Medrash. Who could possibly, there can only be one child who answers that description. Mizrachnik. So what was the answer? So what's the answer? Shnei Goyim Mivinech. So his quote, Besser Tzvei Goyim von einem Mizrachnik. It's better two Goyim than one Mizrachnik. Which of course was his style, and it's not the only such word he had. But also pointed out what he would say, what he saw as a schizophrenia, or a certain pull in both ways. On the other hand, it also, the fact that he had to address the issue meant there was a certain vibrancy and a certain cohesion to the movement that he felt was, he had to provide a response. So others would give a more thought out response. His style was to give more flippant responses. But there was a sense that there was something going on that had to somehow belittle what was happening. And what has changed? So I think the answers I've heard from many different people often have been, I've often been, in a sense it goes more or less like this, that what Orthodox is often perceived as being lukewarm, not passionate enough. My father wrote about this in his essay on modern orthodoxy, that on the one hand, the integration can create educational problems, that the passion and is not often the same. There's a lot to this, but the sense is that if to learn properly, if to have long notes, to have long hours in Beis Medrash, to have serious intense learning, for that, one has to be committed. A dual program eventually means you nishtein and nishtaher. This way he put it there, you end up be having the worst of both worlds. Because it's not, it's the commitment to seriousness, to deep learning, to high level Torah mitzvahs, that was lacking. So therefore, the younger generation growing up, perceived modern orthodoxy as a compromise, as a lukewarm compromise, and therefore some more intensity, more seriousness, and crossed the road to a different approach. That's part of the picture, but only part of it. And let me ask it differently, why this happened now, in the past 20 years, let's say, and not 40, 50, 60 years ago? The answer, of course, on one level is that society was a different place. I'll explain in a moment, but there's also something else going on here, which I think, or at least I haven't seen it been pointed out, seems to me at the root of a good deal of what's, of where contemporary modern orthodoxy is at the moment, and by identifying this, to be then still before, try to point out directions for the future. Essentially, modern orthodoxy, as presented certainly in this neighborhood here, Torah Mada, presents an ideological movement. It's an ideology which believes in fusing together two elements in which there is an inherent tension between them, meaning, on the one hand you have revelation, on the other hand you have human wisdom, on the one you have Torah bilvad, Torah is self-sufficient, on the other hand you have other sources of knowledge, human investigation, the world at large, there's a tension or there's a question about how appropriate is it to use sources rooted in thought systems which don't buy into our basic axioms? Or to be more explicit, can you really utilize sources taken from thought systems which are secular in their basic outlook? The scientific outlook and the religious outlook are often clash, and many scientists approach this from such a perspective. Can you then integrate or not? These are deep basic issues and go to the heart of the question whether life should be dialectic or should be more monolithic. Can a person, the core of the Rebbe's philosophy in a sense was, you have clashing ideas or you have different elements, each of which is important and valuable of itself. However, each one also is at tension with other elements. For instance, Chesed versus Deed, or Shalom versus Emes. The Gemara says, "Sahed davav, Emet u'mishpat Shalom shiftu b'sharichem. Im yesh Emet ein Shalom, im yesh Shalom ein Emet." Obviously, Shnayim ochzim betalis. Two people hold on to the same garment. So, if you want Shalom, you say Achloku, divide. You want Emes, they didn't pick up together. The odds of picking up together are very slim. Even though we shouldn't talk about that, we don't really assume they pick up the same moment. So if you want compromise, you want shalom, you say to them, split. No one will be totally happy, no one will be totally unhappy. On the other hand, if you want MS, so chaz shalom, let's check it. So you say, other solutions, toss it up, or kol dalim gavar. You want MS, you don't, you're raising a child. You want MS, you insist upon discipline, you insist upon self-reliance, you don't pamper him. By doing so, you create a lot of discipline, a lot of MS. You can't express warmth, you can't express love. On the other hand, you want Ahavan Chesed. You do the opposite. You shower with so many gifts and so much attention and love that you spoil him. He's pampered, he's spoiled. He can't manage on his own. So there's tension between Emet and Shalom, between Chesed and Din. Should we give tzedakah? Emet says no. Sheli, sheli, shecha, shecha. Chesed says yes. And the Rebbe's whole point was that the two are in constant conflict. You have to do both. You cannot, by doing both, you pay a price. Your Emet will be Emet, your Shalom will be Shalom. Nevertheless, the sum total will be greater than each. Or to put it differently, if life pours you two glasses to drink, you cannot drink both. If you have two glasses, one hot, one cold, a cup of tea and a glass of water, or a Coke, you can choose either or, you can choose to drink one and not the other, and then you'll enjoy it totally, but you'll be unaware of the value of the other, or you can drink both. By doing so, each will take a price or cause you not to feel the total benefit of the other. And the Rav's determination, the Rav's decision was, or guidance was, that you should choose both and pay prices. That's just dialectic, because dialectic means you can never fully realize both ideals. Each ideal will only be partial. V'olam hazeh. Oseh shalom b'mromav. In the heavens, everything goes together. In this world, there are always prices. I was asked to speak recently about the Hesder, to explain, to justify the Hesder. That's a basic point. If you believe that Torah is important, if you believe that serving the army, furthering Am Yisrael's goals in Eretz Yisrael, if you believe in shouldering the burden is a value, You can choose to either or. You can be 20s in yeshiva and become a yeshiva. You can be 20s in the army and become a general. The Hesder assumes neither. The Hesder assumes that you'll do both. By doing both, you pay a price for your Torah, you pay a price for your army service. But nevertheless, you have done both and participated in both elements, and you will not have chosen either or, unlike some other systems who prefer either or. Now, I think this is the basic idea of the Rus philosophy in general, and modern Orthodoxy is another manifestation of this. You can choose either Torah alone. If you're Orthodox, you can't really choose only Chochmah without Torah. But modern Orthodoxy says, I won't choose Torah alone. I will fuse the two. I'm aware there are tensions. I'm aware there's dialectic. I'm aware at times I'll pay prices, be it in time simply, but only in time. The two differing perspectives may also create a real inherent tension, but nevertheless, by believing that both derive from sources, which Kadosh Baruch Hu sanctioned, in other words, one is revelation through the written word, one is revelation through our lives, through the world, through reality, so we have to choose both. And this was the Rav's basic choice about life in general. I said before, it's not only modern Orthodoxy. Modern Orthodoxy is another example of applying his dialectic to life in general. Whenever there are two things, kol nikra bishmili chvodi brati v'tzatir v'sitiv, everything in the world Kadosh Baruch Hu created as a positive element, you now have to somehow combine them. Loneliness and happiness, chesed and gvura, shalom and emes, chachma and Torah as well. Now as such, it's an ideological movement. And if you read some of the writings which have been written by modern Orthodoxy, you take Rabbi Lamb's book, you take my father's essay, etc., etc., it's presented more often than not as an ideological movement. Rabbi Lamb, in his book, he presents different models of why to integrate the two. He tries to deal with various claims against modern Orthodoxy. But it's essentially presented as an ideological movement. And as I said before, it's an ideological movement which makes certain assumptions, makes some major assumptions, as I said before, that about Torah, about what Torah includes, what doesn't include, about the aims of Torah, about the need to tap into other sources. By the way, we could talk about minhag and halacha the same way. Minhag is a form of revelation. A written halacha is a form of revelation. How do you fuse halacha and minhag? We have different approaches there as well. However, all this is assuming the modern Orthodoxy is an ideology I should choose from. I can have religious Zionism, I can have Satmer, I can have modern Orthodoxy, I can have an anti-modern Orthodoxy approach. And as I said before, Rabbi Lamb and the like, he's trying to compete with Rabbi Chanan Wasserman and his claims against such an approach. And of course, it goes back way to the 12th century, to the Rambam, and those who are against the Rambam, and all the controversies surrounding the Rambam. And it goes back before that. By its essence, by its very definition, the question of combining Torah with Chochmah is inherent tension, or to put it differently, it's a galgal chozer ba'olam. It will always, you always confront the same tension. However, that's only half the story. And the other half is, modern Orthodoxy was really a historical movement. It was an ideological movement. The question was not, do I believe or not? In a sense, it was a movement at a certain place in time, and now I'm not talking about the Rambam. I'm talking about from where we're coming in our contemporary existence. It was a movement to people at a certain place. You could say, to put it more specifically, begin in 19th century Germany, and of course confront the 20th century America as well, in which people were exposed to modernity. For various reasons, the reasons at the moment are irrelevant. Why did they decide to be modern? But they were modern. And the question that became, if you're a Rav in Germany in the late 19th century, early 20th century, if you're in America 1930 or 1950, you had a Balabatim who were modern. And they had no plans of being anything otherwise. It wasn't a question of should you advocate to them becoming modern Orthodox or Haredi. They were modern. The question was, should they be modern Orthodox or modern non-Orthodox? Modernity was a given. In other words, we're going to go to the movies, that we're going to have a modern lifestyle, that was never open to debate. The question was, do you go to the movies with a kippah or without a kippah? Do you have such a, do you go on academic career when you are integrating your Torah and your belief with that? Or do I, would we tell you the Torah compatible, and therefore Torah will be the one that gives way? In other words, a whole group of thinkers, or actually communal leaders in Rabbanim, felt they were facing historical circumstances in which modernity was considered a given, because people, that's what they wanted, that was the way the world was going, that was progress, that was the evolution of society, and that was the reigning set of belief. Moreover, it wasn't only a set of belief, it was a lifestyle. And they set out to allow people to remain from religion. It wasn't a question of giving them ideology, you know, it's all the inspiring rhetoric of modern orthodoxy at its best was not the issue they were confronting. That was not what they were advocating. They were just trying to reconcile, to take an example from Israel. It's the same to the army. The question of Hezder wasn't only a question of, do you believe in fusing Dat and Le'om and do you see Pamei Mashiach and the like? The question was, let's face it, these people are going to the army, so we might as well help them do it in a better way in which they're able to, like the Nachal Charedi nowadays. People who advocate Nachal Charedi do not claim that ideologically they believe this is the Chatchila. They claim their kids who are out there who cannot survive within the habitat they have otherwise. So therefore, we have to have an outlet for them in order to allow them to remain from and within. And it's not as seen as a dream, the realization of a dream. It's simply as an educational tool to help them, to give them a safety net, really. This is true then, to a large degree, of society at large, that it was seen as a safety net to allow people to do the lifestyle they were determined to have. And not that they articulated in these words, but implicitly that's the way they were living their lives, and to provide them with such a safety net. If anyone reads Professor Mordechai Breuer's book on German Orthodoxy from 1871 onwards, that's the controlling idea of the book. The modern Orthodoxy was not an ideological movement, it was a practical movement, a safety net. I'm not an expert historian. My impression is he overstates the case. It's a bit one-sided. But clearly, he certainly makes the case that modern orthodoxy was simply to allow the Chevre to remain within both worlds. And there's no doubt this was part of the deal, that a good deal of modern orthodoxy indeed was established in order to allow people who felt this is their lifestyle they want to be able to do it beheter, and to do it in a way that was compatible with their belief. That, and it could very well be the people who were guiding them also believed as a system. But beyond that, they were also catering to a crowd who was not interested in the intellectual subtleties that Rabbi Lam is writing about, my father writes about. They were simply wanted a way to feel comfortable with their lifestyle and their upbringing. Now, as such, it achieved great results. It's hard to imagine the United States, the Orthodox of the United States at the moment, without that. There would have been a small, deeply committed core, but so many other people would have been lost. And, you know, it was achieved in many ways, by modernizing the aesthetic of the shul, the aesthetic of the siddur, by developing also a philosophical justification. In other words, it wasn't only by making shuls which were more amenable or more similar to institutions which were non-Jewish institutions. It was also achieved by providing the philosophical and ideological framework. But, as I said before, the framework was to allow people to live within both worlds. Without this, orthodoxy would have diminished, would have shrunk in size, that the reservoir of people later on to become more intense and more yeshivati never would have existed to begin with. Without such a bridge to bridge between the world of the time and the contemporary world, probably the vast majority would have been lost because they were not about to forfeit such a lifestyle. However, there's a price to be paid for that. The price is, if this is your mindset, you arrive at modern orthodoxy not from a position of strength, but from a position of weakness. But you're not saying, as if I believe in this, this is the best of both worlds. I'm fusing revelation of the world and revelation of Torah. I'm fusing an understanding of the human nature and the divine will. I'm not providing the best of both worlds. It's not the best that was thought. It is not the most uplifting. It's not the most spiritually rewarding. But simply, practically speaking, it's the best way to keep people from. So, and essentially, what you're saying is, Nachamai Balabatim, if I have to choose, if push will come to shove, and I'll back them into a corner, I'll have to choose. I'm not sure what they're going to choose. Therefore, I won't have them choose. But by doing so, you basically arrive at from a position of weakness. It's not a position of strength, but of weakness. So essentially, modern orthodoxy comes in two flavors. It comes in one flavor, that of the ideological one, which comes from a position of strength. I mean, no one can look at modern orthodoxy as an ideological movement and deny its potency, its vibrancy, and its value. It's no accident, if to talk about the past, that the Rambam, who was exposed to Greek culture and to Greek science, produced the most, and let's say almost the only organized work. The Rambam knows what organization, what classification is. Try to find something in Sefer Itur. Sefer Itur, Sefer Halacha, which was presumably written for people to use. How is it organized? It's organized by the following acronym. Tashkev Begeza Chochma. Why he read that, I don't know, but that's the organization of the simanim in the Itur. So it goes from Shtaros to, I forget, to Kabbalah Seidus, to whatever, that's the way it goes. Tav, Shin, Tuf, Pei, Bet, Gimel, Zayin, Ein, Chet, and it's almost impossible to find anything over there. Try to find something in Hilchot Shabbos in the Iranian. You have no way of figuring out, Hilchot Shabbos there is a huge passage. How can you find anything? You can't. You have to read the whole thing, page to page. And so on and so forth. The Rambam did it. He was organized, obviously, because he was impacted by organization he acquired, and so on and so forth. And there's no, so as an ideological movement, it certainly is uplifting and provides many, and there's much to be said. And I said before, I think others have written about it and articulated it better than I can. They've written about how the benefit of providing culture and Torah is so great, and come from Eretz Yisrael, I said before, it's indeed felt. You can often feel in Eretz Yisrael that what's lacking is, in a sense, this exposure to culture, and a little more exposure to this would enrich your spiritual life over there. However, that's only one flavor. And that was the flavor, I would say, maybe of the Yechidim. The other one was the historical flavor. Simply as a need, an educational, historical answer to a particular situation, that from one you come from a position of strength, from the other you come from a position of weakness. And that's in a sense, so really you had people like the Rav on the one hand, on the other hand you had people simply, you know, this is the only way to keep them within the fold, to stay from... Often, and I remember people speaking to the Rav, you know, Viz Balabatim that he encountered, and they belong to the same movement, subscribe to the same ideology, but coming from such different places, not only because he was more profound than they were, because the starting point was different. The starting point was one of, on the one of commitment to Torah and then integrating modernity, but the other one was not a formal commitment, but deep down, a sense that I will be modern because this is what my intuition, this is what my desires are, and therefore I have to attach this on to allow me to continue doing this. Now all this, this is the way I understand how modern Orthodoxy, in a sense, in the United States, it's not originally, at least, how it expressed itself. Position of strength, position of weakness. An ideological movement, a historical movement. Now, why not become a... Why does that mean modern orthodoxy? Because there's a sense... And here I'm going to make an assumption, but... As I go along, why I think it's so. Most people, deep down, were not interested in the ideology. You know, most people were not. We have those who were, but deep down, most people were really interested in the lifestyle. What they really came about modernity was to feel comfortable in society, was to feel comfortable with the lifestyle. You know, most people are not philosophers. But they do live in a certain society. They want to feel comfortable with it. Now, there was an assumption, which at the time was true, and still is true in Israel nowadays, that you can't have it both ways. In other words, if you want to be Haredi, you're insular philosophically, and you have insular lifestyle. In other words, you have to be, on the one hand, if you don't read Shakespeare, Dostoevsky, Kant, etc., etc., you also don't enjoy the pleasures of a modern lifestyle. If you turn your back on modernity, if you think that the Torah, true Judaism, quote-unquote, is one which is insular, so you're interested in the whole package. The lifestyle package can't be separated from the ideological, philosophical package. And therefore, it's a package deal. Either you sit in Bnei Brak, and the Bnei Brak, so you're not exposed to any of these cultural figures, you're not exposed to Darwin, you're not exposed to Freud, etc. And you also don't tap into the benefits of technology and the like. You don't have a modern lifestyle either. On the other hand, if you want a modern lifestyle, you can't have that without subscribing to ideology. If you believe in the achievements of modernity, has to go hand in hand with recognition of its ideological axioms, of its philosophical theories. So if you subscribe to modern, if you want a modern lifestyle, you want the pleasures and the amenities of a modern lifestyle, you also have to send your kids to a modern Orthodox school and let them read Shakespeare and let them be immersed in culture, let them study science and so on and so forth. So therefore it was a choice. You either, the package deal, you have to choose either go one hand and have neither, or go to the other and have both. Now, that being the case, modern Orthodox was an appealing choice. People want to become Orthodox. I said deep down, many people felt they required or desired a modern lifestyle. So they realized that this was the accompanying, if you want, the prize, but this is the corresponding element which had to go hand in hand with that. And therefore they sent the children to modern Orthodox day schools, and so on. What's happened now in Eretz Yisrael, that remains the situation. In Eretz Yisrael, if you're in Bnei Brak, you are still cut off from the internet. You are still, the standard of living is much lower than Ra'anana or Petah Tikva or whatever. Your cell phone is supposed to be with a Hechsher, the Rabbanim, of course not against Lashon Hara, no SMS, no text. You can go in Israel and get a telephone kasher. And telephone kasher means that it's technologically limited. And your autonomy is limited. The fact of the matter is, the lifestyle is indeed much less, and quote-unquote standard of living is lower than corresponding modern Orthodox communities. And that same package remains, in effect, more or less. I'm not saying at the sides, there aren't, it's not being nibbled away at the sides, but broadly speaking, that still remains the case in Israel. Over here, in the past 20 years or so, I'm not committed exactly the date, what's happened is a sea change. What's happened is, this package has become unraveled. In the face of the morning, Pardacha Vila. You can now, and this is the genius of various black and white is the word Haredi. Various Haredi movements which cater to the American scene now, which basically come and say, we will provide you with the lifestyle, but we will, but within the Haredi context, no longer, if you're insular, you're not going to be insular from the lifestyle. You can be insular from the philosophy, but you don't have to be, you don't have to withdraw from the corresponding modern lifestyle. You get the technology without having to be part of the ideology. Or to, I was in a community outside the United States once, a person had in his study a huge picture of Rav Shach beneath his golf clubs. Now I'm sure if Rav Shach had seen the picture, he would have turned over his grave. And if anyone in Palm Beach or Denver had seen that, they would have thought that, you know, it's Hagam Nichboshet HaMalkai Mibabayit. That you can't do, this doesn't work. If you want to play golf, be modern Orthodox. In Bnei Brak, that's indeed the case. It's either or. I think United States and in probably broadly speaking, other countries in Galut, that's no longer the case. You can have the golf clubs under a Shach's picture, and it's not just incompatible. And the person's self-image was perfectly, I think, intact. Someone once described it to me as being Haredi on Shabbos, modern Orthodox on Sunday. Which is the same idea. The idea really is that the Sunday, which is a lifestyle day, so a modern Shabbos, which is a firm or a religious philosophical day, then I'm not modern. And it's basically the same phenomenon. This seems to me the major change. It's not that the ideology has become any weaker or any different. Either you, if the ideology appealed to you 50 years ago, it should still appeal to you now. If you believe in the, you know, if you believe that the Rav's ideology and the Torah Mad ideology and the Torah Derech Eretz ideology is correct, it hasn't lost any of its force or any of its vibrancy at the, you know, relative was 50 years ago. What's happened is that those who used to subscribe from a position of weakness because they had to have the lifestyle now have the best of both worlds. They can have the lifestyle without having to subscribe to this. Now, this is an achievement because if you were only subscribing it from a position of weakness, only because you wanted to justify your lifestyle, so deep down you felt it wasn't as authentic, it was indeed lukewarm, it was parav. Because if your motivation deep down was not because you recognized the beauty of wisdom, it's not because you said that you really saw culture as inspiring and challenging, but you simply saw it as a heter, to use the Rebbe's phrase, as a matir, to engage in modern lifestyle. So now you get a better matir, one that's more authentic, one which doesn't have all these complications of the dialectic attached to it. One which is not, doesn't cause such tension within you. You can now have a relatively plain, simple religious ideology, which is authentic, which has the way of tradition behind it, which is just continuity of the world in Eastern Europe, or North Africa for that matter, and at the same time, enjoy the lifestyle. So now, all those people who were, quote-unquote, forced against their better judgment to subscribe to modern ethics in a position of weakness because they wanted such a lifestyle, no longer need that. They can now go, as I said before, on Sunday, enjoy everything that the American leisure system has to offer. Or the same time, Shabbos, not have to cope with issues of this dialectic. And all that group has now been cut off. In other words, they belong to a world which is modern, which is part of society, which enjoys the latest gadgets, which enjoys the leisure, but nevertheless does not subscribe to the ideology. So before, in Eretz Yisrael, I think it doesn't happen. It's there, you still have to make the choice. Over here, though, it does happen. And therefore, the numbers have diminished. The numbers have changed. The dynamic has changed. Because before, deep down, most people are not philosophers. Most people are not intellectual. And what they desire is really simply, you know, let us enjoy our lifestyle with legitimacy. They cannot get the legitimacy from other movements just as well. And we're talking about people who are media savvy, who understand the culture very well, who provide a sense of belonging to popular culture. I mean, mainly, so now the numbers have diminished, the sense of retreat, it's a regression. And of course, these people, all people who in a sense, they or their parents or their siblings or whatever, were in the system from the position of weakness. So now they feel stronger and more empowered. Now they feel that they're in a better place, and in a sense they are in a better place. In the sense of, it's greater commitment because their commitment was different before. So having said this, so now you have many people crossing the street, and moreover, I said before, this is not the only dynamic. There are other dynamics which I'm well aware of, but I think I'd like to add in those relative to people who have spoken to us on other occasions, and I also lack time, so I'm not going to talk about other dynamics such as choice of profession, how that impacts upon who enters into the educational system, etc. But the sense of there's a greater, for those switching, there is indeed a greater commitment and a greater sense of wholeness because their rationale to begin with was different. And now you have a dynamic which already is set into place in which there's regression, there's retreat, the tide is going against you. And the major change, like before, I think is simply that the connection between lifestyle, the Ali was unraveled. Now, one could give a whole lecture, and one could still ask the question, well, who's right? Are the Israelis, is Eish HaTorah right, or are the Israelis right? Is it indeed internally consistent? Is it a good idea to say, let's enjoy technology, but not subscribe to modern ideology, or is it inconsistent? That would require a whole discussion, and the answer may not be that simple, and would require maybe a more nuanced discussion. But the fact of the matter is that this is the dynamic. Now, when this brings to us, up to now, is it's time to analyze the situation. What does this bring us to? It brings us, in a sense, if we're to a sense of retreat, of the sense of being more authentic than the other is a non-modern Orthodox movements. In that sense, when you come here, you feel often from the outside, you feel a sense of lack of self-confidence, you feel a sense of being unwilling to justify what's going on. But on the other hand, Lanyudati presents a huge opportunity. When you had a broad, I'll take an example from Kashrus to explain the point. When a Mahadrin Hechsher has a huge advantage, a huge disadvantage. A Mahadrin Hechsher, at least in Israel, it's not out to cover everyone. The Rabbanut has to have a Hechsher for everyone. If there's no Hechsher for the Rabbanut, the people will eat it anyway, it's a betrayal. In other words, if the Rabbanut will give a hechsher on a yogurt, so even if they give a kula on various issues, could be chalavakum, could be gelatin, whatever the makel on, so by doing so, then they ensure the product is kosher, and there's chos and maizos are taken off, and shemitah is observed, and they don't use non-kosher milk, etc., etc. However, by seeking for a broad common denominator, you lower the bar. When Mahadrin Hechsher assumes that only those are committed will buy it. The non-Mahadrin Hechsher assumes, if I provide the Hechsher, people will buy it. If I don't, they'll still buy it. In the Mahadrin Hechsher assumes, they only buy it with the Hechsher. So if I can raise the bar, and only if I feel comfortable with, will I authorize? I don't feel comfortable with, I'll say no thank you, and people won't buy it. Now, this is the analogous situation over here with modern Orthodoxy. As long as it had to be the safety net for everyone, it had to provide a safety net for those in position of weakness. It had to say to itself, if I provide the Hechsher, they'll buy it, and if I don't, they'll also buy it. So therefore, I have to provide the Hechsher. And if it means lowering the standard or seeing a broad common denominator, it's a mitzvah d'oraisa. As I said before, I think that to a large degree, the vibrancy of Orthodox at the moment is only because there were people who had the vision and the wisdom to lower the standards and to create a broad common denominator, and by doing so, to have, to keep so many people within the fold who otherwise would have been outside the fold. And the yeshiva world of today is based upon those very families, without whom, had they been the very ideology which belittles that at the moment, or the very ideology of being belittled, was the modern orthodoxy, if not for it, there never would have been the contemporary yeshiva world, because there wouldn't have anyone to draw from. There wouldn't have been a pool of people to even to begin to draw who could then change their ideology, because they would have been lost. And by creating this broad common denominator, and by lowering the standard, as I said before, like in the Kashrus, it's what saved to a large degree orthodoxy, and it certainly allowed it to thrive and flourish the way it is at the moment. So therefore, it was the right thing, and I really think required great vision and visionaries to rise to the historical challenge. However, now, our position is no longer that of the Rabbanut Hekshir, because now, others are doing the same thing. No longer does modern orthodoxy alone have to provide the safety net. The safety has been provided by many other movements. So obviously we want to be involved in that, to provide a safety net, assuming that by doing so we're able to give people the ideology as well. However, now that we are not the only ones providing the safety net, and there are others doing the same, we can now focus upon those who subscribe from a position of strength. We now have to come out and say, this is not for people who want this lifestyle, therefore we will provide them with the institutional, the ideological framework. It's rather, now is the opportunity, because that is no longer such a pressing need, to come and say, we'll raise the bar. We will now present modern orthodoxy as a proud movement, one which champions an ideological element, one which talks about having the best of both worlds, one which no longer must simply allow people to stay somewhere within, but one which will demand of people. If you want to be with a modern lifestyle, there are many organizations, many movements, which will give you the halachic know-how, which will give you the shul, which will give you the school, and allow you to live your life as an Oved Hashem, enjoying technology and the lifestyle. If you want to belong to modern orthodoxy, begin to confront its messages. Begin to subscribe to its deeper messages. Learn to cope with the dialectic. Learn to engage with this meeting between Torah and Chochmah. It's no longer has to be a historical movement. It can be essentially an ideological movement. By being so, I think historically it will also benefit. It will, by reinforcing the core, it will eventually expand as well. But at the moment, the time is ripe to no longer having to make it seem like this is simply lowest common denominator. It's the opposite. It has to be presented now as a higher common denominator, as a higher elevation, as a path which is not for the masses, as a path which is not for everyone, which a person has to be well thought out, has to be committed. In other words, it's time to shift from the historical to the ideological flavor of the movement. And by doing so, to recapture the sense of excitement, the vibrancy, the sense of energy, and the sense mostly of spiritual accomplishment. The sense of people who are committed, the sense of people who feel passionate about what they're doing, to get people within the movement because they really believe you get the best out of this. There's a medieval analogy. Spain was, on the one hand, apparently, once more, I'm not a historian, but the impression one gets from reading both sources and historians is Spain was less, quote-unquote, firm than Ashkenaz, but achieved tremendous achievements. In other words, even if we assume that there are people there who subscribe to positions of weakness, but can you imagine Yiddishkeit without the Ramban al-Torah, without the Mor Nevuchim, without the Kuzari, None of these works emanated from Ashkenaz. Let's compare Sefer Hasidim to the Kuzari of the Marne Vuchim. Compare the Chumash Parshanut from Ashkenaz, what's going on with Ramban, Ibn Ezra, Merit, and so on and so forth. How much more impoverished would we be without such works, which came to fruition in a particular culture and environment? Now, I think this is what we have to come and present to people. The challenge is to create such works. It's to have a world of Tanakh which is more vibrant, a world of Tanakh which is more insightful, more profound, because by engaging culture and literature and art and philosophy, you end up with a more profound outlook on life, and strive to create such parshanut, to create Torah itself. And I think we have an obligation to Torah itself. I'll explain what I mean. Torah, at the end of the day, is the meeting of ideas, capital I, and life. In other words, Torah is not only an abstract system of ideas, and I've read the Shalacha, but nevertheless, I repeat this. Torah is the meeting, is the application of ideas to the real world. And as such, confronting the world, not as a place for fun and lifestyle. In other words, not Torah and fun, but Torah and Mada, Torah and Chachma, confronting the world, confronting history, confronting science, gives you a better appreciation of the world. And therefore, Torah itself can benefit, because if you have to have the two meet, and the dynamic of the world is crucial to understand how Torah applies to it, so the better your knowledge of the world, the better your understanding of Torah itself. The more profound your Torah is, the more you understand the world. The more you understand human nature, the more profound your Torah is. The more you understand science, the better your Torah is, etc. To the extent that we believe that modern orthodoxy has the ability, for most people, there are always, of course, exceptions who don't need it, but has the ability to provide insight to human nature and to the world at large. And once more, this can be done from a position of strength. So then, Torah itself will benefit. And modern orthodoxy has to present itself as a vibrant world which is contributing to Torah, which is making Torah greater and better Torah, be it Tanakh, be it Torah Shebaal Peh, be it Halacha, and by presenting it as such, it will do Torah service, it will do itself a service, it will enhance and intensify and mostly deepen its ideology, and I think eventually also attract more people. People are attracted to intensity, but I think there's indeed an opportunity, because the moment that there are other alternatives for those who just want the lifestyle, we can now go look inwards and be ikar, depthwards, look down to the depths and plumb these depths for greater understanding. That's why, even though the sense of retreat and regression at times, because those who are in for a position of weakness are now shifting to other pastures, it also presents a huge opportunity, which I think the American public at large, the American Orthodox public, of course, and particularly the educational system, particularly the schools, the mechanchim, be it Shiva Gvoha, be it high schools, be it Rabbanim and Shuls, the educational system has to regain its pride and its self-confidence, and it will do so by realizing that this is not a movement which grew out of weakness, the way it was perceived because of the historical element, but a movement which is rooted in very deep ideology, and as such will be presented as a movement full of strength from a position of self-confidence. And this was at Hashem, we're able to renew it and allow it to go to greater achievements. Tadarabah.